From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly podcast about the Iowa legislature. Week 8, intermission. Well, kinda.
We're finishing up our first funnel, and so this is always a big week and kind of an exciting week in the legislature.
House Speaker Linda Upmeyer during a Republican leaders' press conference Thursday morning.
Now we will debate the bills and move them forward so they can go through the Senate because they have to accomplish another funnel.
Representative Upmeyer is talking about the deadlines all bills face. Today, Friday, is the first funnel deadline. It means a bill has to have passed a committee by now in order to be debated on the floor. A second funnel is coming soon that eliminates more bills. In some ways, funnel week is like an act break in a movie. Not only does it serve to eliminate bills, but it also gives leaders a chance to reflect on the first half of the session.
I was hopeful at the start of the session, but look at what's coming at us.
Rob Hogue is the Senate Minority Leader speaking during the Democratic leader's Thursday morning press conference.
There has been so much nonsense coming at us this week.
All the major bills from the Republicans are passing, often after vigorous debate, and there isn't any sign of this stopping.
Just today, we've got a subcommittee going on right now on something that is not a state issue related to immigration issues. At noon, we've got a death penalty subcommittee. I understand there's just been a bill yesterday filed in the House that would interfere with teachers' ability to teach and mandate that they're required to present opposing points of view on evolution and global warming. I mean, this is just nonsense after nonsense after nonsense.
Representative Upmeyer is asked about Senator Hogue's characterization of the Republican agenda as nonsense.
Are you surprised by their hyperbole? I'm not. This is what we've been hearing, and it's genuinely hyperbole, and so I'm not surprised. Of course, they're talking about that. We've been very successful in moving forward, and they're having a tough time refuting substance. So we hear hyperbole.
One issue coming before the chamber soon is a bill expanding gun rights. Representative Matt Winschittle is the Republican bringing forth this bill. 2 weeks ago, at the conclusion of a subcommittee, which included public input, he says he understands this is an emotional, controversial issue.
Our intent is to protect Iowans at all costs, and this will allow Iowans more freedoms and the ability to exercise those freedoms in a responsible fashion. We're not trying to put the guns in the hands of the bad people. We're not trying to allow for people to do things criminally. We are trying to respect Iowans' rights. Thank you, sir. I appreciate your commentary.
This week, as the bill is discussed in the House Judiciary Committee, Representative Mary Wolf opposes it.
Under this bill, under Division 10, it is clear that creates a new category of things called violent crimes for which a person is authorized to use deadly force. And violent crimes include felony burglaries, and burglary third is a nonviolent offense that includes breaking into a neighbor's storage shed to take tools, walking into a detached garage to take a bike. Now, I understand Representative Winschittle's position that it also has to be reasonable, but by putting into code that deadly force can be reasonable when used to prevent or terminate a burglary third, clearly it contemplates that there will be circumstances where it will be reasonable. And I would say any time a person sees a burglary third taking place is too far away to stop it. Clearly the police aren't going to get there in time. I do not know how under this bill, how it would not be reasonable to shoot them, because that is the only mechanism you have available to terminate or prevent that burglary. Now, from any logical or humane standpoint, is it ever reasonable to shoot another person to protect a piece of property? No. Under this bill, this bill says it is.
2 days before this committee, we invited Representative Mary Wolf and Representative Matt Winschittle to the Capitol's Law Library Monday afternoon to talk about this more. This is from our talk show, River to River, hosted by Joyce Russell and Ben Kiefer.
Well, I think the bill as a whole is very important to Iowans, and I think that the base premise behind this is to expand Iowans' freedoms and protect their Second Amendment rights, open up their opportunities that have currently been restricted by state government. I think some of the most important things in here would deal with allowing a parent to be able to make the decision when they should teach their children proper handgun safety. Some of the other portions in here that deal with the renewal of permits and how permits are issued, that's of great importance. If you had to ask me to pick one over the other, I probably couldn't do it because these are all very near and dear to my heart, and I believe that these are all good proposals moving forward.
Representative Mary Wolf, a Democrat of Clinton, you're with us on this conversation. React to this slew of changes as a whole and then perhaps to the preempting local ordinance as part of it.
Sure. So this bill is, what it really is 12 smaller gun bills that have been combined, and we've dealt with several of the individual divisions, the individual baby bills, in the House over the past two terms. And I will say that all of those bills that were run in the past individually were able to gain bipartisan support. They passed the House with bipartisan votes, and that was partly because we were given the opportunity to vet the bills, to discuss them with Representative Windschuttle, to work on the language together before we were forced to vote on them. So there are still a lot of things in HSB 133 that I support, and I think that other members of my caucus would support. The problem is that it also includes some really big policy changes that we haven't had a chance to vet. And it also includes Division 10, which deals with a overhaul of Chapter 704, which is Iowa's current justification self-defense law. And with all due respect to whoever drafted it, I think it's drafted extremely poorly. I don't think it does what it's intended to do. And I think it would make it very difficult for prosecutors to convict a lot of guilty people, which, you know, perhaps that was the intent of the bill, but I doubt it. So I'm happy to hear that Representative Windschuttle has listened to one of the criticisms of the bill and was willing to respond to that. There are quite a few other criticisms that I believe are valid and that I would like to work with him on. However, we do have a funnel coming right up, so I doubt that we'll be able to get that done prior to being required to vote on it in judiciary. So I'm disappointed that a bill of this magnitude that is proposing such major policy changes, for example, doing away with mandatory permits, that we weren't given more of an opportunity both to work on it as it was being put together and also to discuss the bill, to ask questions of experts. We had a subcommittee meeting, in which we weren't able to ask any questions because we spent the hour taking input from the public, which on the one hand was good. On the other hand, that's usually what we do in a public hearing, not a sub. So, I mean, I'm hopeful that there still may be some opportunity for amendments, for compromise, and I guess we'll just have to see.
One of the other aspects of this bill that's been much talked about, the stand your ground provision. We know of this from many other parts of the country, I think first enacted in 2005 in Florida. This, broadly speaking, correct me if I'm wrong, but removes the duty to retreat before using force in self-defense, Representative Windschuttle. So you can be threatened by someone if you reasonably believe that that your action will, using even lethal force, will prevent death or great bodily harm. You can do that? Is that basically the intent behind Stand Your Ground?
The base premise behind Stand Your Ground is to ensure that a citizen who is ever faced with one of those dire situations is able to defend themselves or someone that is nearby if they are acting reasonably and they do not have a duty to retreat. So if this were to go before a judge or a jury, the jury instructions would not include that they had to first consider if they could run away from that situation. Keep in mind, the way that we've crafted this language, I understand Representative Wolf and I may disagree on the actual aspects of the language, but it is to make sure that folks are acting reasonably. So this is not vigilantism. This is not authorizing anybody to go out and pull a weapon on anybody else and just blow them away because they were scared of them. This is crafted in a way to make sure that it is one of those dire situations where someone's life is threatened.
Just to clarify, the other controversial part of that is that it spells out that a person may be wrong in their estimation of the danger or the force necessary to repel the danger. so long as they act reasonably in response to their belief. And we're going to be hearing, I believe, a little later from an African-American woman from Des Moines, one of the African-American Iowans who spoke out on this last week. They believe that merely being black sometimes communicates danger or creates fear, and that this is going to harm them. I know, Representative Wunschtel, you spent a long time with those folks after that subcommittee. What are you telling them to alleviate their fears?
We actually had a very good conversation, and I expressed to them exactly what the bill will do as it's laid out. And in the course of that conversation, I made it very clear, this is not targeted towards any one specific group or sector in Iowa. This is for all Iowans. This is to provide the protection for anybody who finds themselves in a potentially very risky or life-threatening situation to be able to stand their ground if they so choose. It just removes that duty to retreat. I also brought up to them the case of J. Rodney Lewis, who did stand his ground a few years ago in Des Moines, ended up spending 112 days in Polk County lockup, lost all of his possessions, and at the end of it, he's acquitted, and the folks in the trial said, well, the jury system worked. Well, it didn't work for him to spend 112 days in jail. He was being attacked by two other people, he stood his ground, and yet he ended up losing all of his earthly possessions because he was in lockup and couldn't post bail. That is a travesty of justice, and that's the type of protection that we're trying to put in place so those type of things don't happen again.
Well, one of the things that the police chiefs were pointing out in the news conference this morning, I believe a Democratic legislator also made this point, that in Florida, the number of justifiable homicides doubled after they passed Stand Your Ground. Is that a legitimate concern about this?
You know, I've heard that specific topic thrown out, that whenever a state has passed Stand Your Ground laws, that their homicide rate has gone up.
Justifiable homicide was what it was.
Well, most of the time people have said they're homicide, right? They haven't used the terms justifiable. However, you know, we heard similar things about doom and gloom when we passed Shall Issue in 2010. People said there was going to be blood in the streets and we were going to have vigilante justice. We're now 6-7 years later. We've got over 260,000 Iowans that have a permit to carry weapons. And I have yet for someone to bring before me a case where someone has erroneously abused the law under the permit to carry weapons system. Iowans are reasonable, responsible people. What we're trying to do with this law, this proposal, is to allow them the opportunity to make the decision for themselves without having to first try and find a place to run away.
Let's talk also with Nathan Gibson. He's been on our program before. He's at the State House Law Library as well. Nathan, welcome back to our program.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me on.
You live in Johnston. You're a gun rights advocate, and you're from a hunting family. We had you on before when you talked about your daughters, teaching them to use firearms safely, and you're a big backer of one of the facets here that would allow minors, actually under 14-year-olds, to use handguns while under adult supervision. Why do we need that?
So a couple things. Probably the first is Iowa is the only state in the nation that has this restriction. So my daughters and other youth can participate in competitive sport shooting, and parents can teach their children's gun safety in 49 other states. But Iowa, for some reason, has this restriction on the books. So for me, the biggest thing is obviously I want to be able to teach my kids gun safety because I have firearms in the house and not be a felon in the process. But more importantly, this is my daughter's sport. This is something they have a passion for, and something that currently I have to drive to Illinois, of all places, for them to participate in their sport. So again,
is there any low end limit to this? I mean, a 10-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old. Is there any low end restriction?
So here's the deal: reasonable parent. A reasonable parent is not going to give a firearm to a child who's under, under a certain age, right?
But I'm talking about the law. What would this new law permit? Not any reasonable parent, but could I have my 8-year-old or my 6-year-old handle a weapon if I was supervising and shoot at a shooting range?
Yeah, absolutely. There's the way the law is written right now, there is no age limit. It brings the current law, it brings pistols into standard with the current law, which states that a child can hold a long rifle or a shotgun at any age. It just strikes the provision that for whatever reason is limiting pistols. So it's just bringing current law or pistols into standard with the current law on firearms and long guns. Sorry, long guns and rifles.
Nathan, do you believe this makes our state safer?
Absolutely, right? We want to teach our kids firearm safety. We want to be able to talk to our kids about both the dangers and the sport aspects of using firearms. So if we make it illegal for parents to do that, obviously parents aren't going to be able to teach your kids firearm safety and kill the curiosity, so to speak, right? So that was the main reason I started doing this, and how my children got into sports shooting is because I didn't want them to be curious of the gun, to pick one up when I wasn't around and over at a friend's house. So, you know, fortunately, no one knew about the law at the time, and I am not a felon, but now I can't do it because most people obviously know that this is Iowa law. Remember, farmers across the country, the majority of Iowans do not even know this is the law, and they take their kids in the back to plink a .22 revolver, and they're felons, and they don't even know it.
Nathan Gibson with us, a Johnston gun owner there, explaining his backing of one of the provisions in the comprehensive gun bill going through the Iowa legislature. Also at the State House Law Library with us, a final guest at the Law Library to introduce, Amber Gustafson is the leader of the Iowa chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Welcome, Amber.
Hi, thank you for having me on today.
I understand there are several provisions of the bill that your group finds concerning. Tell us.
Yes, there are several things that stand out to us as things that we really question whether they're needed in Iowa. Ones that really are of special concern to us would be anything that has to do with removing background checks on handgun sales, or anything that does away with the permitting process. So those are the things that we're really focusing on right now, but there are certainly other aspects of the bill that we are extremely concerned about as well.
Mm-hmm. And Amber, specifically, does this bill do that, eliminate background checks to the degree that we have them now? Do you see that in the bill?
Well, I am not an attorney. I am a volunteer, and I am a mom from Ankeny. And so I leave the sticky legal questions to the attorneys and the legislators in the room. Okay. But I have seen things that definitely do concern me because in, for example, Missouri, our neighbor to the south and a place where my husband and I lived a few years ago, we have seen many of the types of changes that are being proposed in the omnibus bill right now. And it has had a detrimental effect in the state of Missouri. And I'm a person who cares very deeply about law enforcement and safety of our law enforcement community. And we do know that removing background checks on all handgun sales, states that that's the law of the land, have 53% more cops that are killed in the line of duty with guns. So that's extremely concerning to me, and definitely not a direction that I want my state to go in.
A representative of the Iowa Department of Public Safety clarified that part of the bill for me. It does, as I said before, it eliminates the permit to acquire, and it makes voluntary, no longer mandatory, a permit to carry. And so, and both of those are avenues by which background checks occur for private gun sales. So, according to the Department of Public Safety, indirectly then, it would eliminate those background checks for private gun sales. Representative Winchittle, how do you address that concern about the elimination of background checks?
Okay, I've got to state this very clearly so everyone can hear it. This does not eliminate background checks. I'll say it again. This bill does not eliminate background checks.
Let me clarify, Representative Winchittle. For private, according to the Department of Public Safety, for private gun sales, it would eliminate background checks because these permits would no longer be required, or required to have those background checks. Federally licensed gun dealers, of course, would still require a background check. So you just disagree with the DPS?
I disagree with the way that this is being interpreted. Because of the way that we're moving to a lifetime permit potentially within this bill, the permit to acquire becomes redundant. So the elimination of the permit to acquire actually moves us forward in having more people go through more background checks more often. Right now in Iowa, you can get a permit to acquire that's valid for 1 year. It's printed on a piece of paper that anybody could print up on their computer at home and make it fraudulently if they really wanted to. You can then go down to an FFL dealer and point of sale. You can buy as many firearms as you want, pistols, revolvers, long guns, under that permit to acquire, okay? What we're doing with this, and at that point of sale, you never go through another NICS background check. What we're doing with this, with the elimination of the permit to acquire, anytime someone goes to an FFL dealer and does a point of sale...
FFL is a federally licensed...
Federally licensed dealer. Okay. Yes. Anytime they go to your Shields or your double barrel shooter supply, which is a family gun shop back home, any of those places, They would then be required to do the NICS instant background check on every purchase of every firearm, okay? So the person-to-person aspect of this, currently the law says that if you're going to sell a pistol or revolver to someone, that you have to at least verify or try and verify that they've had a permit to acquire. Anybody that has ill intent could fraudulently print up a permit to acquire. The way we reword it in this bill is that that person needs to know, or reasonably should know, that that person is not prohibited from having a firearm. And if they don't do that, it can be a Class D felony. So as we're moving forward, we're actually putting a further restriction on this to make sure the people are doing their diligence. Me as a personal, as a individual citizen, if I'm going to sell a firearm to somebody and I want to make sure that I am completely covered, I'm going to take that firearm to an FFL dealer, have them run the next background check before I transfer it to anybody else. That's the way that we, citizens can be protected with this.
And the lifetime permit, that will be, that's still optional though, right? A lifetime permit?
The lifetime permit would be optional. And keep in mind, once that permit, after the five-year window on that permit goes invalid, every time a person would purchase a firearm after that at an FFL dealer, they're going through that background check at that point of sale, that NICS background check that's mandated by the federal government.
This question from Paul via email, will this bill permit a permit holder to enter a government building with a weapon such as a courtroom? Representative Winchittle.
Yes. Can you please restate the question?
Will this bill permit a permit holder to enter a government building with a weapon such enter a courtroom, Paul emails, for example?
The way that I've crafted the amendment, the current bill as it stands, no. A court or a judge could put a prohibition on carrying into a courtroom or areas that are primarily used by the court. The amendment that I have that makes changes for just like the community colleges and universities, courtrooms and government buildings would be treated the same way. If they're going to provide 100% protection and security, then they're going to also be able to assume liability and put a firearm prohibition in that location. That's part of the amendment that I will propose before we move the bill out of committee.
With the many facets of this omnibus bill, the Democrats, of course, not in the driver's seat in either the House or the Senate in our legislature. Where do you see this going? Do you feel you get a fair hearing and there will be some amendments here? But, or will it be rushed through and you'll be disappointed on some aspects?
Well, I think that is entirely up to the majority party. Certainly, I wasn't able to ask any questions during the one subcommittee that we had on this bill. And my understanding is we're running this out of committee on Wednesday. So maybe I can ask questions then. I would like to just a couple of things. One, this bill absolutely reduces the number of mandatory background checks that people would have to get. It does away with the mandatory background check. It comes along with obtaining a permit to carry, and it does away with the mandatory background check that's required to purchase a handgun from a private party. So it does say that if you know or have reason to know a person is not eligible to possess a gun, you can't sell it to them, but it doesn't create any duty on the part of the person doing the selling to do anything to find out. So if anything, it encourages a seller not to ask any questions and not to run somebody's background. The other thing is there's so many people who do not know that they are legally ineligible to possess a firearm. It's very complicated. The rules governing who can or who can't, I'm a lawyer and I don't think I know them all. So people who had a mental health adjudication when they were 14 cannot legally possess a firearm. People who had an old, you know, disorderly conduct, but the person, the victim was a spouse, they can't. So hundreds of people who apply for permits are turned down by DPS because they have a disability that they had no idea about until they got the background check. Under this bill, people in good faith will carry a firearm in public who are committing a Class D felony under federal and state law. And that's not good. We're setting people up to break the law. And again, should they know these things? Maybe. But, you know, Mr. Gibson wasn't aware that it was a crime to allow his children to use a handgun. And okay. And so that's a problem.
Representative Wolf, we're running out of time. Please, a brief response to that, Matt Winchittle.
I appreciate what Representative Wolf is saying, but I think a lot of folks don't fully understand how firearms transactions work when you go to an FFL dealer. If you do not have a permit, you have to go through a background check. It is federally mandated. So every time you go to a point of sale on an FFL, you're going through a background check. As far as the language about a person-to-person sale, we have crafted it in a way that someone has to know or reasonably should know that person does not have a firearm prohibition. If somebody transfers that firearm and that firearm gets used in the commission of a crime, they're coming back to that person who previously owned it, and they're going to get charged with a Class D felony. I guarantee it.
They can't.
Okay.
Representative Winchell, I want you to address something that the police officers were talking about in the news conference this morning. Without the required permit to carry a weapon, whether concealed or open, they're concerned that there will be more open carrying of weapons. The Des Moines police chief said, we already get calls about people openly carrying weapons. This is just going to explode with that. What do you say about that concern?
I say that there is a large misunderstanding across the state of Iowa, including with law enforcement. I respect them for all they do and the job that they, the service they provide to all Iowans. Iowa is not a concealed carry state. We have never been a concealed carry state. Anybody that has a permit, of the 267,000 Iowans that currently possess a permit to carry, they could all open carry right now anywhere in the state.
Not in urban areas.
Yes, ma'am, they can. Yes, ma'am. Right. Iowa has never been a concealed carry state. So even if someone wants to have a permit to carry right now and carry in urban areas, they absolutely can. That is permissible under state law as it's currently written. And
well, according to the Department of Public Safety, a permit is required within the limits of any city to go armed with a pistol or revolver or any loaded firearm of any kind, whether concealed or not.
That is current law, because the way that law was written was if you were outside of the incorporated limits, you never had to have a permit, but you had to carry openly. Our permit to carry authorizes every person that has that permit to carry openly or concealed. It circumvents that.
Representative Matt Winchtittel with Representative Mary Wolf, speaking from the Capitol's Law Library with River to River hosts Ben Kiefer and Joyce Russell. The bill expanding gun rights passed a committee this week. There are some changes since our conversation with the representatives. The bill originally allowed weapons to be on a college campus, but this has been removed. Also, originally, the bill would have gotten rid of mandatory permits to acquire and carry weapons. That would have meant no background checks for private gun sales. This is also no longer part of the bill. You are listening to the weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, highlights from the Iowa legislative session. I'm John Pemble. There isn't much discussion in the House or Senate this week. Mostly it's been procedural gaveling in, proving the journal and points of personal privilege. Legislators have been spending most of this week in subcommittees or committees. Because it is final week, if a bill doesn't make it out of a committee, that is the final step before it goes to the floor. The bill is done for the year. Here are some bills that are not going to make it. Proposed education savings accounts, where parents could choose to use this money from the state to send their children to private schools. Death penalty is out. It didn't even have a subcommittee meeting, although one was planned but had to be canceled. And a bill proposed by the governor to clear the way for more for-profit healthcare facilities is one that did not make it past a Republican-dominated panel. It's hailed as free enterprise issue, and advocates say entrepreneurial physicians ought to be able to set up clinics that provide some of the same services as a local hospital. Doug Cropper with the Genesis Hospital Network says he's as free enterprise as the next person, but
I'm a Republican, just like you, and I voted Republican my whole life. So why am I opposed to this bill? Because healthcare is different. The free market does not work in safety net services.
Critics say for-profit clinics can cherry-pick patients, while the community hospital is there 24/7, providing comprehensive healthcare. Backers of the bill say hospitals are holding entrepreneurial physicians hostage. A bill to ban protesters from blocking Iowa roadways will advance to the Senate. It's a reaction to an incident on Interstate 80 in Iowa City last November when protesters shut down lanes for half an hour. They are objecting to the election of President Trump. It's already illegal for protesters to block traffic on an Iowa highway with a posted speed limit of 55 miles an hour or more. Under this bill, penalties would gradually increase. Senator Jake Chapman says it's important to update this law because the current $35 penalty for participating in this kind of protest does not fit the crime.
It's a matter of time before people are significantly hurt. And so we want to make sure that the penalties fit the crime. And so we might disagree on whether or not that's reasonable. I think it is.
A third offense would be a felony with prison time of up to 5 years. Senator Tony Bisignano opposes the bill.
I in no way condone people that jeopardize other people's health or safety, but I do respect the First Amendment, and I do think this is an overreach, and I think it's politically motivated.
A handful of other states are also considering tougher penalties for protesters. There are four bills quickly moving forward in the Iowa House of Representatives, and they will have public hearings early next week. Three of them are on Monday. Monday morning, input will be sought for plans to reorganize the Des Moines Water Works. Then in the evening, the public can comment on a voter ID bill and also a bill that would not allow counties to set their own minimum wage. Then on Tuesday, a bill that would limit workmen's compensation will have a public hearing. Should be a busy couple of days with many for and against voices at the Capitol early next week. And we'll hear some of them on our next podcast of Under the Golden Dome. This is week 8 of our mini-series about the Iowa legislature. Originally, this session was scheduled to go 110 days, as does the first half of a General Assembly, but it was cut to 100 to save money for this fiscal year. There are a lot of big bills ahead, and they have about 6 weeks to finish, or per diem expenses will run out for legislators. Typically, when a session goes beyond the schedule, it's the party leaders that stay behind for the most part. Depends on how long things go. 40 years ago, 1977, a session went on for 188 days. It involved a five-day special session in June. While this is not likely in 2017, you should always be on alert for the unexpected in Iowa politics. Think about it. 1 year ago, who thought our governor would be resigning to be a U.S. ambassador? This weekly podcast, Under the Golden Dome, was conceived by Iowa Public Radio News Program Director Catherine Perkins. Editorial support comes from News Director Michael Leland. Stories for this show come from our Statehouse reporter Joyce Russell. Clay Masters also contributes to the series, as does our talk show team and River to River host Ben Kiefer. Kay Henderson from Radio Iowa lends a hand to our efforts as well. Most of the reporters working together at the Capitol are always ready to help their colleagues from all kinds of networks, all kinds of platforms. We all want to get the story right. I'm John Pemble, host of Under the Golden Dome. Week 9 promises to be lively, and you can hear the highlights when our next episode is released Friday afternoon from iowapublicradio.org.